Her own feelings were overshadowed entirely by the magnitude of Sean's sorrow. She had developed a deep affection for Job, but it was as nothing compared to the love that she now saw laid naked before her. It was as though that pistol shot had destroyed a part of Sean himself, and she experienced no sense of shock or surprise when he began to weep. Still holding Job in his arms, Sean felt the last involuntary tremors of dying nerves and muscles grow still, and the first chill of death sap the heat from his body he hugged so tightly to his chest. The tears seemed to well up from very deep inside of Sean, and they came up painfully, burning all the way, scalding his eyelids when at last they forced their way between them and rolled slowly down the darkly weathered cheeks into his beard. Even Alfonso couldn't watch it. He stood up and walked away into the thorn scrub. But Claudia could not move. She went on kneeling beside Sean, and her own tears rose in sympathy with his. Together they wept for Job. Matatu had heard the shot from a mile out where he was guarding their rear, lying up on their back spur to watch for a following patrol. He came in quickly, and from the bush at the perimeter of the camp watched for only a few seconds before he deduced exactly what had happened. Then he crept in quietly and crouched behind Sean. Like Claudia, he respected Sean's mourning, waiting for him to master its first unbearably bitter pangs. Sean spoke at last, without looking round, without opening his eyes.
"Matatu," he said.
"And you, Bwana?"
"Go and find the burial place. We have neither tools nor time to dig a grave. Yet he's a Matabili, and he must be buried sitting up, facing the direction of the rising sun."
"And you, Bwana?"
Matatu slipped away into the darkling forest, and at last Sean opened his eyes and laid Job gently back upon the grey wool blanket. His voice was steady, almost conversational. "Traditionally, we should bury him in the centre of his own cattle kraal." He wiped the tears from his cheeks with the back of his hand and went on quietly. "But we are wanderers, Job and I. He had no kraal, nor cattle to call his own." She was not certain that Sean was speaking to her, but she replied, "The wild game were his cattle, and the wilderness his kraal. He will be content here." Sean nodded, still without looking at her. "I am grateful that you understand." He reached down and closed Job's eyelids. His face was undamaged, except for the chips from his front teeth. And with a fold of the blanket, Sean wiped the blood from the corner of his mouth. Now he looked peaceful and at rest. Sean rolled him on his side and began to wrap him in the blanket, using the nylon webbing and the rifle slings to bind his body tightly into a sitting position, with his knees up under his chin. Matatu returned before he had finished.
"I have found a good place," he said,
and Sean nodded without looking up from his task. Claudia broke the silence.
"He gave his life for us," she said quietly. "Greater love hath no man."
It sounded so trite and unworthy of the moment that she wished she hadn't said it. But Sean nodded again. "I never was able to square the account with him," he said. "And now I never will." He was finished. Job was trussed securely into the grey blanket, only his head was exposed. Sean stood up and went to his own small personal pack. He took out the only spare shirt it contained and came back to where Job lay. He knelt beside him again.
"Goodbye, my brother. It was a good road we travelled. I only wish we could have reached the end of it together," he said softly,
and leaned forward and kissed Job's forehead. He did it so unaffectedly that it seemed completely natural and right. Then, with a clean shirt, he wrapped Job's head, hiding the ghastly wound,
and he picked him up in his arms and walked with him into the forest, cradling Job's head against his shoulder. Matatu led him to an abandoned ant-bear hole in the thorn forest nearby. It was the work of a few minutes to enlarge the entrance, just enough to slide Job's body down into it. With Matatu assisting him, Sean turned him until he was facing east, with his back to the evening star. Before they covered the grave, Sean knelt beside it and took the fragmentation grenade from the pocket in his webbing. Matatu and Claudia watched as he cautiously rigged a booby trap with a grenade and a short length of bark twine. As he stood up, Claudia looked at him inquiringly, and he answered her shortly, "Grave robbers." Matatu helped him pack stones around Job's shoulders to hold him in a sitting position. Then with larger boulders they covered him completely, building a cairn over his grave that would keep the hyena out. When it was done, Sean did not linger. He had said his farewell. He walked away without looking back, and after a few moments Claudia followed him. Despite her sorrow, in some strange way she felt privileged and sanctified by what she had witnessed. Her respect and love for Sean had been reinforced 100-fold by the emotions he had displayed at the loss of his friend. She felt that his tears had proved his strength rather than betrayed his weakness, and that rare demonstration of love had only pointed up his manhood. From this terrible tragedy, she had learned more about Sean than she might otherwise have done in a lifetime. They marched hard that night. Sean forged on as though they were trying to outrun his grief. Claudia didn't try to slow him. Although she was now lean and fit as a coursing greyhound, she had to put out all her strength to stay with him, but she did not complain. By sunrise they had covered almost 40 miles from where they had buried Job, and ahead of them lay a wide alluvial plain. Sean found a grove of tall trees to give them a little shade, and while Claudia and Matatu prepared their meal, Sean slung his binoculars across his back and stuffed the field map into his back pocket and went to the base of the tallest tree. Claudia watched him anxiously as he began to climb, but he was as nimble as a squirrel and as powerful as a bull baboon, using the brute strength of his arms to haul himself up the smooth stretches of the bole where there were no footholds. When he neared the top of the tree, a white-backed vulture launched herself from her shaggy nest of dried branches and circled anxiously overhead, while Sean settled into the fork of a branch only a few feet from the nest. The vulture's nest contained 2 large chalky white eggs, and Sean murmured soothingly to the bird, still cruising high above, "Don't worry, old girl, I'm not going to steal them." Sean did not share the popular distaste for these birds. They performed a vital function in cleansing the felt of carrion and disease, and while grotesque in repose, they were models of elegance and beauty in the air, masters of the sky and of natural flight, revered as gods by the ancient Egyptians and other peoples with a close affinity to nature. Sean smiled up at the bird, the first smile that had bent his lips since Job had gone. And then he gave his full attention to the terrain spread out below him. The alluvial plain ahead had been intensively cultivated. Only scattered groves of trees still stood between the open fields. Sean knew that these would mark the sites of the small family villages shown on his map. He turned his binoculars upon them. He saw at once that the fields had not been tilled nor planted for many seasons. They were thick with the rank secondary growth that invades abandoned cultivation in Africa. He recognized the tall, harsh stems of hibiscus irritans, named for the sharp, fine hairs that cover the leaves and which brush off on anyone that touches them. He saw castor oil bush and cotton gone wild, and the orange-coloured blossoms of wild cannabis, whose narcotic properties had first so delighted Jack Kennedy's Peace Corps boys and girls, and which over the years since then had given solace to the hordes of other European and American youngsters who had followed them out to Africa, equipped only with backpacks, dirty blue jeans, good intentions, and a hazy belief in beauty, peace, and the brotherhood of man. Recently, fear of AIDS had slowed their arrival to a trickle, and Sean was grateful for that. He realized his thoughts were wandering, and he pulled himself up and panned his binoculars slowly across the scene of desolation ahead. He could just make out the roofless ruins of the villages. On some of the huts, the roof timbers were still intact, but skeletal and blackened by flames, the thatch burnt away. Though he scrutinized the area meticulously, he could make out no sign of recent human presence. The paths between the field were all overgrown. There were no sign of domestic stock, no chicken nor goat, and no telltale tendrils of smoke rising from a cooking fire. Somebody, Frelimo or Renamo, has worked this area over pretty thoroughly, he thought, and then looked away to the east, to the distant blue hills of the interior. This early in the morning the air was still clear and bright, and he was able to recognize some of the features and cross-reference them to the topography of his field map. Within 15 minutes he was able to mark in their position with reasonable accuracy and confidence. They had made a little better progress than he had estimated. Those mountains out on the right-hand side were the Chimanimani. They formed the border between Mozambique and Zimbabwe, but their nearest peaks were almost 40 kilometres distant. His map was marked in kilometres, and Sean still liked to work in miles rather than the metric scale. The larger village of Dombi should be a few kilometres out on his left flank, but he could pick out no indication of its exact whereabouts. He guessed that, like the other family villages ahead, it had long ago been abandoned and allowed to return to bush and forest, in which case there would be little prospect of finding food there. With so many feeding from it, the small quantity of maize meal they had been able to bring with them was almost expended. By tomorrow, they would need to begin foraging, and that would slow them up. On the other hand, if Dombe was still inhabited, it would certainly be either a Frelimo or a Renamo stronghold. Prudently, he resolved to avoid any contact with all other humans. Nobody, not even Alfonso, could say which territory was held by the opposing forces and which was a destruction area devastated equally by both sides. Even those boundaries would be fluid and would alter on a daily, if not hourly, basis, like the amorphous body of an amoeba. He looked directly southward along their intended route. In that direction, there were no features rising above the plain. This was a part of the littoral that stretched down to the shores of the Indian Ocean, and no mountain nor deep valley ruffled it. The only natural obstacles ahead were the dense hardwood forests, the rivers, and the swamps that guarded the approaches to them. The largest river was the Sabi, or the Rio Save, as the Portuguese named it, as it flowed in across their border with a land that was to become Zimbabwe and down towards the ocean. It was broad and deep, and they would probably need some sort of craft to make the crossing. The last river, Rudyard Kipling's Great Grey-Green Greasy Limpopo River, all set about with fever trees, was the final obstacle they would face. It was still 300 kilometres further south. Three national borders converged and met upon its banks: Zimbabwe, Mozambique, and the Republic of South Africa. If they were able to reach that point, then they had reached the northern boundary of the celebrated Kruger National Park, heavily guarded and patrolled by the South African military. Sean studied the map longingly. South Africa and safety. South Africa and home, where the rule of law still held sway and men did not walk each moment in the shadow of death.